Thank you very much for the introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to talk to you this afternoon. It can sometimes be a burden to be an early afternoon speaker, because you come right after lunch, all blood is in the lower vessels, not in the upper ones, unfortunately. But in my case, I think myself rather blessed, because the morning speakers were so excellent that I have the slight hope that the memory of them has faded a little bit during the lunch break, so that you might suffer my talk. The subject is fiat money and wealth, so it's related to some of the concerns that we've discussed today and also yesterday. In particular, I think I'm thinking here of Olivier Richard's talk as a reluctant, his experiences as a reluctant taxpayer. So we know that government is not the invisible hand, but the grabbing hand, as the grabbing hand of the state is persecuting it. And we also know, at least those of us who have to manage wealth or do have wealth or are interested in financial news, we know that governments have made great strides in the past 6 years or so into gaining access to the wealth of their citizens, which is a historic, singular situation. I might remind you that in former times, when financial markets were not a tenth of what they were today in importance, it was much more difficult for governments to control the wealth of the citizens. Most wealth was held in forms very difficult to access for governments. Coins stored at home under the pillow. I have good reflexes though, for an old friend. He had this breakthrough, he said, Guido isn't very old. I said, oh, it's not that old, that. Old and good friend, so I was okay. Old friend, yeah, it's okay. So storing coins under mattresses, under pillows and so on, so a piece of land and so on. So it's very difficult for governments to gain access to this and use this kind of wealth. They can do this, but only by sending in many people. It's a very expensive undertaking, so in most cases it's not worthwhile. It's very different if people have a major part of their wealth invested in financial titles, on financial markets, then it's very easy, or comparatively easy for governments, especially governments that are ruthless enough, to gain access to that kind of wealth. It's sometimes very easy, you just need to change a few financial regulations, right? And then the intermediaries with whom we have invested our money are forced to invest their capital with governments rather than investing them somewhere else. So it's a very easy way, convenient way for government to get a hold of this. They can do various other things. They can expropriate wealth that is held in financial form, because we today typically do no longer hold, for example, stock certificates. If you buy stock in a company, you typically no longer hold the stock yourself. It's always the intermediary that holds the stock. So a government who wants to expropriate all our stock possessions does not need to send in police officers into each individual household. They just need to send a few people into the companies that manage these financial titles and grab them, the grabbing hand. So things have become very, very easy for governments to control wealth. So what can be done here? How can we get out of this? And the question is related to another, how can we get out of this question that I've been asking myself for many years. I was not the first one to raise this question. It's a classical concern of Austrian economists, namely the question of monetary reform. How can we get out of the present fiat money system into a more natural monetary order? For example, by reinstigating some sort of a gold standard, by bringing about currency competition and other things that give back liberty to the citizens to use and also to produce the best monies that they can think of. Now, one common objection to libertarian monetary reform, abolishing the monopoly privileges of central banks, abolishing fiat money, legal tender laws, and so on, and thus bringing back natural money such as gold and silver into the market, one common objection was always, well, that this would entail immediately a meltdown of financial markets. And the reason is that most financial investors today are highly leveraged. Now, I must maybe say a few words to explain this point to people who don't think usually a lot of financial markets. To be leveraged means to have invested based on debt. Right? So you go into debt, you take out a credit in order to buy something else. Take out a credit with a bank and you buy stocks or maybe Greek government bonds or something else that is very risky or less risky. So that means being leveraged. Now, leverage has certain advantages about which I will talk later, but it has, of course, also a very big disadvantage, namely that it carries the risk of bankruptcy, of insolvency. You might be incapable of paying back the debt. If your investments turn sour, you will not be able to pay back the debt, and thus you lose your wealth and your capital, as Mr. Lowe has reminded us before, right? You lose your capital if you're a professional investor. And thus you're out of your market, you lose your power also, and political, economic problem. Why do people go into, why do they leverage their investments? Well, because they can count in the present system on the assistance of the central bank. The central bank does certain things, which I will mention later on in more detail, that make such behavior worthwhile. So if we take away the central bank, it's like taking away the punch bowl from a dinner party. Right? Some of the guests might still hang around, but it's no longer the same mood. And then, right? And if people were just on the edge, actually the atmosphere might collapse. Right? You take away the punch bowl and you substitute a milkshake, might actually create many sour faces. So it's a little bit the same thing, only much more dramatic. Right? If you take away the central bank, then many of the investments that have been started can no longer be carried out. So the financial markets would melt down. Thus goes the concern, well, if this happens, then of course, monetary reform of this sort would be a shot into one's own leg to a large extent, right? So it's, because financial markets hold all our wealth. They're important to finance not only governments, of course they do this, but also companies and also households. So such a reform seems to be ill-advised and should be avoided. What I would like to do today is to give you some counter-arguments against this line of reasoning, because I happen to think that actually even if we had a meltdown of this sort, and probably it would be unavoidable under any reasonable libertarian sort reform agenda, it would carry great advantages, especially from a financial point of view. It would create great advantages for the creation of wealth and for the allocation of wealth, so the way we use our wealth. In order to explain my point, I will first talk a little bit about how finance would operate in a free market system. So we'll talk a little bit about natural finance. And then, and here I will suppose that in such a system or such an order, financial order, would be based on a natural money such as gold and silver. And then, in a second step, I will highlight the changes that come about by introducing a fiat money into such a system, how the way we finance our activities change, how the way we use our wealth change. So what does it mean to finance an activity? To finance an activity, of course, we think, well, means to provide means of payment to buy all the nice things that we would like to buy. It means to provide money so that we can buy more houses and more cars or hire additional people and so on. But for an economist, this is a very unsatisfactory way of defining finance. What finance means, basically, and I won't talk a lot about this, means to provide real resources to enable people to realize their projects. That's what finance means, to provide real resources for people to realize their projects. That's also the etymological root of finance, right? Finance comes from finare, it's a Latin word, fine, medieval French, finir, today's French. It means to end, to finish, to accomplish. Finance is that which allows us to accomplish our projects. And of course, projects cannot be accomplished with money unless the project is papering a wall, maybe, or something like this. Right? Finance always necessitates real resources. And so when we get a credit from a bank, what the credit really does is to enable us to buy those real things that we need in order to realize our projects. And of course, this also means then that other people who otherwise would have bought the same things that we now buy are not able to buy them. So we are able to buy them because we can offer better terms, typically pay higher prices. Therefore, the owners of those things that we would like to use sell them to us rather than to other people. So from which follows immediately that now monetary finance, right, never creates real resources. It just changes in the short run, it just changes ownership of things, of real things. People who get finance, monetary finance, are enable to pursue their projects at the expense of other people who cannot. And then the big $200 trillion question is, how does this look like from an aggregate point of view? Is this beneficial from an aggregate point of view? So this is our subject. So let's first think a little bit about finance in an economy in which there is no fiat money, which we would have, for example, to make matters very simple, we would have a gold standard. Now, the defining characteristic of a gold standard is that it cannot be produced at will. Right? So you have mining costs, it's very expensive undertaking, so you can only produce so and so much gold per year. So the money stock is very strongly limited. In such an economy, therefore, there is a tendency for the price level to diminish, and especially if the real economy is growing at the same time. More and more goods in a real economy are being sold into the market, and if the money stock doesn't change, or it doesn't change very much, then of course it's possible to sell all those goods and services only at decreasing unit prices. Okay? Well, this is a crucial feature. So how would people then finance themselves in such an economy? The basic source of finance would be revenue, okay? It's not banks, it's not the stock market, it's not the bond market, it's revenue. It's the amount that of money that you earn by selling goods and services to other people. That's your main source of finance. That doesn't change, by the way, in any form of economy so far. Then there are also other sources of finances, in particular financial markets. So what is the financial market? It's a market of financial exchanges in which we exchange promises of future payments. If I'm a company, I sell you stock, my company, then you give me your money right now and I sell you a piece of paper, which is in fact a promise that you will share in the profits if ever I make some, that you will get a vote in electing the management of the company, the directorate, if ever you have voting rights associated with your stock, and so on. And you will benefit from a share in the liquidation proceeds if ever the company is sold. If I'm a government and I sell you government bonds, then I sell you a promise. You give me your money now, and I sell you a promise to make future payments to you, interest payments, and eventually restitution of the amount that you lend me. So this is a financial market. Of course, a financial market is necessarily based on trust, right? So in a natural economy, in a free society, trust is paramount on the financial market, and trust is personal. It's not, we don't have an abstract trust in something, somehow things will go well. We have a trust in concrete persons, you and you and you, and you have trust in me. Or we don't cooperate them through financial exchanges. It doesn't happen. There's another thing that very strongly limits financial markets such a free society, namely the prevalence of money hoarding. In a free society, people would tend to hoard a lot of money. And this is a direct implication of the fact previously mentioned, that in such an economy, the price level would tend to decrease. If prices drop, let's say, every year 5%, then this means that by just holding money, you will earn a 5% real return, 5% additional purchasing power on the money hoarded every single year. So therefore, you have a very strong incentive to actually hoard your savings, not to lend them to somebody else, but to hold them, keep them under your pillow, dig out ground into your garden somewhere if you don't trust the tax agents and so on, right? And keep it there. Or you don't trust your neighbors. Now this looks like a big disadvantage, like a big off of a free economy that does not have a fiat money. Right? But in fact, it's not. Hoarding has completely different hoarding of money has completely different consequences from hoarding any other real resource. If I hoard, let's say, water bottles, then these water bottles cannot be used by anybody else but me. If I have cattle and I hoard my cattle on my own ground and never sell them, I just look at them, how they gaze, and I'm happy to see them. So I'm a very egoistic cattle lover, and I'm stacking cattle on my land. Well, they're just good for me and for nobody else. It's very different in the case of money. If money is being hoarded, then the benefits of this hoarding, of this sacrifice, this act of saving, necessarily accrue to other persons. We cannot prevent this. And the benefits accrue by the fact that hoarding tends to diminish the price level even further. If I hoard money, so I take some of the money that otherwise would be exchanged in the market, I take it out of circulation, so to say. So less money is being available to be exchanged against other goods. So as a consequence, then, if you want to sell these other goods, you can only do so at lower unit prices. The more we hoard, the lower tend to be the money prices, unit money prices of all other things. Now that means, of course, the implication is that if I hoard, so I abstain from exchanging my money, I abstain from spending my money, it means that other people benefit from my act of saving. Other people who still exchange their money, who still spend their money, can now buy more things with the amount of money than they could have bought if I had not hoarded. Okay. So we see here that hoarding has structurally the same consequences and plays the same role in a free society as financial markets. In both cases, the act of saving of one person creates financing, creates finance of the activities of other persons. And it's the same thing. I lend you money directly, okay, you can buy more stuff. If I hoard more, well, you can also buy more stuff because the prices tend to be lower, so your purchasing power of the money that you have increases. There are, of course, also differences, and most notably, there are two differences between hoarding and financial markets, financial exchanges. They are related. The first one is that in a financial exchange, I can target the main beneficiary of my act of saving. If I hoard, I don't know which prices will diminish to which extent. So I don't know the people, the concrete persons who will benefit from my savings. And in fact, the impact on each individual person is infinitesimally small. So it might not even be noticeable. If I lend money to somebody else or I buy stock in a company, then I target the main beneficiary. And as a consequence of this feature, then of course financial markets also permit something else, namely the remuneration of savings. And it's possible then that I strike a deal with the beneficiary and he says, well, not only I will restitute you the money, but I will also pay you a little extra. So suddenly I'm being paid for saving. And as a consequence, then financial markets create something like a financial division of labor. Just as there is a division of labor between a lamp producer and a microphone producer, suddenly a division of labor between savers and the users of savings, or between savers and lamp producers and shoemakers and so on. So in a free society, the structure of finance of society has a very particular shape. Hoarding would play a big role. Investing one's own money in one's own firms also plays a big role. So equity is very important. Hoarding is very important. Debt would not exist to any large extent. Would exist to some extent, of course. It would be something like a credit market. But of course, there would be very strong incentives to avoid credits of any sort, because if you have to repay the money that you get today, you lend money out today, you have to repay it, whatever, in 5 years or in 10 years, in 5 or 10 years, the money that you have to pay back has a much higher purchasing power than the money that you lend out today. Right? So you would avoid taking out money. You wouldn't be leveraged in your investments. Now all these things change once fiat money comes into play. There are a few intermediate steps that I might also have discussed, but I need to finish at some point. So, Let's turn to fiat money directly. The characteristic feature of fiat money is that it can be produced at will. Central banks are today the producers of fiat money. It's not a necessity. It could also be the Ministry of Finance or the Treasury could directly. This is, for example, the plan of Madame Le Pen in France, and as I understand, of certain members of Congress in the United States. Right, so you can produce this type of money without any commercial or technical limitations. You can produce as many banknotes as we wish. Right, you just take this banknote. I have here a Turkish banknote. Right, you see that there is a lot of space here, or you just might move the 100 to the side and add a few zeros. Right? Doesn't cost anything. Okay, there's some costs involved because you need to rearrange the printing machines and so on, but always the same. Paper bill, same amount of ink, and so on. It doesn't change anything. And of course, if you then have electronic money, accounting money, as in central banks, which is the lion's share of today's money supply, then of course it doesn't even cost you the paper and the ink. You can produce as much of this as you wish. Now, some people, they hesitate. They say, okay, Hülsmann is a professor of economics, so probably it's not completely wrong what he says, but it sounds weird. Right, so there's a central bank, and they have a balance sheet, and they have a debt, and they have equity. So how can they produce just as well? They can go bankrupt. And the answer to this question is no, they cannot. They cannot go bankrupt. If you have something to notice, you write this down. Central banks cannot go bankrupt, and you circle it 3 or 4 times. Cannot go bankrupt. And the reason is that the so-called debt of central banks is a legal fiction. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a debt of the Turkish Central Bank. This is a debt certificate of the European system of central banks, of the euro system. Okay. This is debt. Now, what does this debt mean practically? If you have debt, let's say you have a government bond. You know, you take the government bond, you knock on the government's door, on the treasury's door, and say, hey, you guys promised to pay. You better pay it today, because today is payday. And they are obliged to pay. Now, if you knock on the door of the central bank and say, look, this is your debt. Pay back. What does this mean? Well, it means nothing. They might give you out of despair. First of all, the poor guy at the central bank counter wouldn't understand the question. And if he did, then, well, he would give you another bill of 5 or so. Right? This year you offer a bill of 100, you say, okay, this is a radical, dogmatic, and whatever. He doesn't understand central banking. We'll give him 2 50s, right, or 5 20s or something like that. So then you're happy. So always being paid in other fiat money, other non-material money, created by the central bank itself. And because the central bank can therefore create money out of nothing, which is all it needs to pay back its own debt, right, the whole debt concept of, in the case of a central bank, is a legal fiction. From a legal point of view, yes, that's debt. From a practical economic point of view, it's nothing. Okay, they have produced paper, and they say it's debt, but it's not. So they have no debt. And they can never have any debt as long as people are willing to accept their products, namely paper bills and account entries, in payment of goods and services that are being sold on the market. Okay, so a central bank cannot go bankrupt and it can produce as much money as it wishes. What follows therefrom? One consequence that follows therefrom is that, well, so the price level always tends to be higher than it would have been in a free market society. And typically, the price level that we observe under real existing fiat money systems in the 20th century and in our present day produces inflation rates in the low single-digit range, which is some sort of the ideal setting for the main partners of central banks, namely commercial banks. I cannot go into detail, but those who know the subject a little bit know that commercial banks also produce money, namely a special type of money, namely money substitutes. And for commercial banks to function well, they are best served if inflation, price inflation rates are in the low single-digit range. If price inflation rates are below zero, that is, if we have deflation, then few people are interested in a bank credit. There's no business for commercial banks. If inflation rates are too high, 20%, 50%, 100% price inflation per year, that's a very bad business environment for commercial banks too, right? Because they would have to ask for interest rates that are way too high for most companies to pay. So the ideal setting for a commercial bank to operate is in the low single-digit range. And that's exactly what central banks produce. So therefore, we had this kind of environment through most of the past 40 years. Now, what follows therefrom in such an environment? It's clear that the financial structure changes. The first thing to notice is that in such an environment, it is no longer advisable to hoard one's savings in cash. This is, if you hold banknotes for 10 years at an inflation rate of 2%, well, you have lost approximately 35 or 40% of your purchasing power. You hold a banknote of 100 for 10 years, well, at the end, the purchasing power is only what 65 euros had been at the beginning. Okay, if you do it for 20 years, you've lost 50%. If you do it for 30 years, you've lost 75%. So it's no longer a good way to save or to keep one's savings. So what do you do then? Either, of course, you save no longer at all, right? You start buying consumer goods. That's what more people do. So fiat money tends to reduce the overall savings rate within the economy. But then people, when they save, they need to come up with something that protects their savings against inflation. So either they buy durable goods, the price of which rises with the general progression of all prices, which is typically the case with real estate. Let's say if the money supply doubles in the course of 50 years, then by and large, let's say prices will double in the course of 50 years. All prices will double in the course of 50 years by and large. So the house that you bought at in year one, right, will have a price that is twice as high in year 50. So that's one way to protect your savings. The other way to protect your savings is to buy something that gives you a return and therefore compensates you for the loss of purchasing power. And this is where financial markets come into play. And so people buy financial titles because that's a convenient way to be compensated for the loss of purchasing power of their monetary savings. So the demand for financial title increases. Right? Demand increases. And at the same time, there's a separate point, the supply of financial titles increases as well because people are now more willing to take out credits to buy things. They're more willing to do this because they know that the money that they have to pay back in 10 years or in 20 years will have a lower purchasing power than the money that they obtain today through a credit. This is the reason why all young people typically after graduating buy a house on a credit. They buy a house with the maximum credit that they can obtain and then if this is a fixed interest rate, they always have to pay each year, each month, they have to make the same payment. But they can, in an inflationary environment, they can hope that even if they remain as stupid as on the day of graduation, right, they can expect their revenue to rise. And so eventually, right, servicing this debt will become ever easier. So this is so for households, but the same reasoning applies to firms and applies to governments. Right? Governments in a environment in which all prices rise can expect higher tax revenue in the future because all other revenues will increase. So if the tax rates stay the same, and it don't even increase, they will have higher revenue in the future. So governments therefore too, I mean there are other reasons as well, but therefore too have an incentive to take out credits. So fiat money creates huge incentives for financial markets and particularly the credit markets to grow. Both demand and supply on the credit markets increase. There's another consequence, there are various other things, but let me just highlight one consequence that I find particularly intriguing because it also relates to moral issues. This development creates a phenomenon that can be called the insatiability of wealthy persons. In a natural economy, in a free economy, if you increase the savings, if you save ever more, right, virtuous saving circle, right, the economy grows ever more productive, so people have higher incomes, so people can save more and invest more. These additional savings can only be invested at ever lower returns. So in a natural economy, there is, in a thriving economy, which savings increase, there is a tendency for the return on capital, interest rates, profits, and so on, to diminish. Now that means, of course, that at some point, the investment of your savings in companies will lose interest, right, in the true sense of the word. It'll become less interesting for you because if you just earn 1%, well, it's not a big deal. You might just as well hoard this money, or you might just as well spend it on something that gives you immediate pleasure, such as buying a nicer house or making a philanthropic donation and so on. So in a natural economy, there's a tendency as society grows richer, right, that people become increasingly more, disenchanted with commercial investments. So these become relatively less important, and other uses of wealth become more and more important. In a fiat money economy, it's the exact opposite. In a fiat money economy, it's always possible, through a phenomenon that the economists call the leverage effect, it's always possible to increase the return on your investments, if on your personal money, if you finance the line part of it through debt. So in a fiat money economy, in which we have seen there exist strong incentives to take out credits, it's impossible, especially for wealthy persons, to take out more credits than anybody else because they have collateral to offer, right? They already have houses, they already have other financial titles that they own. So they can take more credit out than other persons. So rather than becoming satiated, right, in their investments for commercial purposes, they never reach this point of satiation. Quite to the contrary, it's like right, they are turned into kinds of casino players who once they have or drug junkies, right, who once had the first injection, and then they really find their pleasure there, and they go on and on and on. Two other consequences need to be stressed before I conclude. The first one is moral hazard. Right? Central banks produce money at will, but they can, of course, they lend the money, so they can target the beneficiaries. The beneficiaries themselves maintain business relations with the central bank, and if they are sufficiently important, if the critical size, they are systemically relevant, right, then they can count on further central bank support, ever more central bank credits. So they start doing very silly things, very risky things, because they know that they will be the beneficiaries of such support. And the last point is that, of course, as I've mentioned in the introduction, that the political control over wealth and over the citizens' savings is now greatly facilitated, because a much greater part of savings is held in the form of financial wealth, much greater part than in a free society. Other factors come into play as well, right? There are cultural factors. For example, U.S. citizens typically have a much higher share of their wealth invested in financial products than Europeans, right? In the U.S., it's about two-thirds of all wealth is invested in financial products. And in Germany and France, it's about one-third only. So there are other things that come into play. But as we see now through these theoretical considerations, right, in both cases, both in the U.S. and in Europe, as a consequence of the fiat money system, that share is higher than it would have been if we had a natural money. So in Germany and in France, the amount of financial wealth might be just 10% or 5% under a natural monetary system. In the US, it might be just 50% or 25%. It would be less than it currently is. So I conclude. The permanent increase of the price level that results under a fiat money system is made possible through fiat money and is intentionally brought about under such a system, creates the illusion of wealth. We see huge figures on our bank accounts and our portfolio statements, right, from the firms that we have invested in. So we get the illusion of wealth. This wealth grows every single year. So we lose track of the fact that wealth and finance are ultimately a real phenomena. We have not saved more because we give a higher monetary value expression to the things that we own. We are, as many economists call this, we are in fact in a rationality trap. Our behavior from an individual point of view is perfectly rational. And we do what under current circumstances, fiat money systems, central banks, rising price level, and so on, is the best thing to do for us. But from an aggregate point of view, it is very detrimental. It is detrimental because government can gain much easier access to these resources, thus steer them away from their most productive employments, thus waste our savings. And also because central banks, is the point that I didn't mention, by artificially decreasing the interest rate, falsify investment decisions by firms. From the aggregate point of view, what we truly get is not an increase of wealth, but a concentration of the control over wealth. We get a facilitation of the abuse of wealth and thus of the waste of wealth. And we get an increasing fragility of all financial professionals, that is, of the intermediaries such as banks, investment funds, and so on. So this sounds all terrible, but as I have stated at the beginning, there is an alternative, fortunately, and the alternative is indeed that it's possible to bring about a natural economic order by courageous reforms that would have to start with the monetary system, which would in the short run, and that is sure, bring about a collapse of financial markets. A policy that is not in anybody's short run interest, but would be highly beneficial from the overall point of view, not necessarily in the short run, but certainly in the medium and in the long run. Because what we would destroy is the expression of wealth, the monetary expression of the wealth. We would redistribute wealth away from those people who have gained control over resources through debt to people who are prudent in their management of their own affairs, do not go into debt, and so on. And eventually we would get a more productive, a happier, and a freer society. Thank you for your attention.